today's Teisho is case 44 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku, the P.E.N. Loop. Case 44 is entitled Ka-san's Beating the Drum. Main subject, Ka-san said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. Transcending these two is true passing. A monk asked, what is true passing? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk asked one more, I would not ask you about this very mind is the Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Ka-san said, beating the drum. The monk still continued to ask, when an enlightened one comes, how do you treat him? Ka-san said, beating the drum. Secho's verse, dragging a stone, carrying earth, using the spiritual power of a 10,000-ton bow. Zokatsu Roshi rolled out three wooden balls. How could they surpass Kasan's beating the drum? I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet. What is bitter is bitter. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning, to purify body, mind, and heart in the great way. I had forgotten that Rutgers has a drumming seminar, or like a week of drumming every summer. But I've been reminded this morning and on Wednesday night as well, because there are people outside drumming. It's probably the case that, it may be the case rather, that by the time we're in our fifth sit, if somebody's outside playing a drum, it could be a little bit unpleasant or a little bit undesired. You might have come to the sit this morning, with the memory of many Saturday sits where it's very, very quiet. And really it's wonderful to concentrate. It's really wonderful to concentrate without obstruction. So, one of the great things about this room is that we're really cut off from all of the hubbub around us. When classes change out in the hallway that we just walked through, it becomes extremely loud. And there's always a broken door that slams. People come in and out. If you're not attuned to noise, you don't pay any attention. But if you're interested in a quiet place, any classroom on that hallway would be inappropriate for meditation. So, we're so lucky to find this room, which is out of the way and separated from that hallway by a pair of fire doors, and also by other space that protects us from all those disturbances. There's only one entry into this building, so we don't get a lot of foot traffic and so on. So it makes it an ideal place to sit, and it also has a kitchen, everything one could ask for. And on Saturday, especially in the summer, it's really quite deserted. So you might have come here thinking that how wonderful to be able to just be in a quiet place for 5 hours. And then, lo and behold, sometime around 9:30, the drumming begins. And, it might be hard to concentrate, a little bit harder to concentrate when that happens. And it's possible, if you're not a beginner, to sort of like focus more intensely on your breath or on your koan, and the sound of the drumming creates a kind of a pressure, and it actually pushes you more deeply into your concentration. Now, this is not always possible to do. You know, especially beginners can't do this. When you begin to sit, after like the first 4 months or something like that, if there's sound or ambient sound, it creates many problems for beginners. It's as though somebody's scraping their fingernails on a blackboard. So I can remember when I first started sitting with the Seattle Zen Center, and you know, I used to try to, I was inspired by the evening sits to try to sit every morning. And I was, Barbara and I were living in an apartment house with very thin walls. It was really cheaply built. Probably our apartment was part of a larger apartment at one time. And the landlord had come in and subdivided the apartment. And on the other, in the other apartment next to us, on the other side of this very thin wall, were a couple of Persian, a couple of Iranian graduate students. And I would get up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, which for me at that time was unthinkably early. And I would do zazen, and you know, as soon as I would get up and sit down, those guys would turn the TV on. And it wasn't terribly loud, but it was, I could hear it. And at that stage in my practice, it was like I could not concentrate with that sound. So, you know, finally I just gave up on sitting in the morning, and I began to sit in the afternoon again, and I couldn't sit at home because I think those guys lived with the television on. So that's a difficult situation for a beginner. As you get to be more advanced practitioner, you reach a point where you still hear the sound, but you have a different response to the sound. You still have to concentrate more deeply. You could say you're in a different place in your cultivation of awareness, you know. Let me explain it in a little bit more detail. You know, this koan, beating the drum, actually comes from a passage in the Lotus Sutra, which is a really interesting sutra. You know, many Zen practitioners don't really read the sutras, and I can understand why. I highly recommend reading the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra. And if you get really ambitious one day, you might read the Lotus Sutra, because it's really quite a beautiful sutra and has been quite an inspiration for great Zen teachers for more than 1,000 years. But in the Lotus Sutra, it's really quite beautiful. You know, in early Buddhism, the Buddha had followers, immediate followers, who were known as arhats, A-R-H-A-T-S, the arhats. And so the Buddha taught, you know, English translation of arhat could be like disciples. And the arhats were disciples who had reached complete awakening. So when the Buddha had his complete awakening, he said, I am completely awake. I have a fully enlightened person. And the Sanskrit word for fully enlightened is Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, which means completely enlightened without, you could say, karmic remainder. See? So some people have Kensho experiences. They have great breakthroughs on the cushion. But they still have karmic remainder. You know, they still have mental habits that make them angry at times, or make them impatient, or make them selfish, and so on. But when the Buddha had his enlightenment experience, he was Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, enlightened without remainder. And so, according to the early Buddhist way of thinking, his disciples also became completely awake, fully released, and so their stories of the arhats becoming completely awake. So one of the Buddha's arhats was a man named Mahakashapa. And he was a great ascetic before even meeting the Buddha. And then he basically sat very briefly with the Buddha and had a complete enlightenment experience. Another famous arhat is Shariputra. Shariputra was like this very, very well-educated, very advanced meditation practitioner who had studied with a number of great teachers in the Buddha's lifetime. And he came to hear the Buddha talk, and while the Buddha was describing his path, Shariputra had like a complete awakening experience. So this is a foundational Buddhist teaching. The Buddha had followers who practiced his path and achieved complete awakening. One of them was Shariputra, one of them was Mahakashapa, who is very important for Zen. Another one was Maudgalyana, is another great arhat, and so on. So people think, as a result of that early Buddhism, you know, they think of Buddhism this way. You start practicing, and you gradually work through all your obstacles. And then eventually, you have an awakening experience. We call it in Zen, Dai Kensho, great awakening. And then, you know, all your karma has disappeared, and you are now fully awake. You're fully awake. This is the way probably most people in East Asia think about Buddhist practice, and most people in the West, you know. So I definitely understood the path in that way when I was starting out. So, you know you're unhappy, you know you're not enlightened. If you're a mentally healthy person, you know you're not enlightened when you start practicing Zen. And you can be truthful with yourself about that. And then you start practicing and you do feel better. You feel better and you have obstacles. You work through your obstacles and so on and so on. When people come to Sesshin, they have various kinds of breakthroughs. And so it makes sense that at some point you would have a definitive experience of complete awakening. And it's like, and that's the end of the story, the end. This is the way many Buddhists think about it in the world, even today, especially in the countries that follow more conservative Buddhism, that is Thailand, Sri Lanka, Burma, Laos. Those are very traditional forms of Buddhism, and they tend to see it that way. In fact, you know, they actually wonder how, you know, once you're completely awake, what happens to you, right? When you're hungry, do you take pleasure in your food, you know, because after all, you're supposed to be a Buddha. You're beyond taking pleasure in your food. It creates a problem, if that makes any sense.
do Buddhists feel pleasure anymore, right? Because pleasure, early Buddhists associated pleasure with the samsara, see? That just was more craving. So, later Buddhists, after early Buddhism, Buddhists continued to practice meditation. And they continued to have enlightenment experiences. And they continued to explore the mind and to explore the nature of enlightenment. And eventually the Buddhist community divided. It wasn't like a war, but it was sort of a friendly, you go your way and I'll go my way. And there were one group of Buddhists who are very traditional. They're the ones you find in Sri Lanka, Thailand, and they're very wonderful people, and their practice works for them. But there were another group of Buddhists who are called the Mahayana. And these people continued to explore and examine the mind, and they continued to have awakening experiences and explore the nature of awakening experiences. And they reached rather different conclusion about the nature of reality and the nature of enlightenment. So, you know, one way to think about enlightenment is that you're first unenlightened, and then you have an enlightenment experience, and you now get your merit badge or your a certificate of enlightenment experiences, and nothing bothers you anymore, and you have no more challenges in life, and you're all-knowing, and so on. But the Mahayana people came to a very different conclusion. And in fact, they said that earlier way of thinking is very mistaken. So in the Lotus Sutra, the sutra starts out with the Buddha delivering a Dharma talk. And after the Buddha delivers his Dharma talk, his foremost disciple comes up to see him. And in the sutra, his foremost disciple is Shariputra. And Shariputra actually says, Lord Buddha, I have to confess to you, something. Listening to you talk about your enlightenment experience actually makes me feel deeply ashamed. Because even though you say, I have had Daikensho, my experiences on the cushion don't equal your experiences on the cushion. And I've known this for years. So everybody says the Buddha is fully enlightened, Maha Kashyapa is fully enlightened, Shariputra is fully enlightened, Maudgalyana is fully enlightened. And when they say my name, Shariputra is fully enlightened, I feel like a big phony. The sutra doesn't use the word phony, but he says, I feel so ashamed of myself, like I've done something wrong. I've been practicing all these years, and I have not managed to reach the attainment of you, and I still feel, I feel ashamed of failing. I feel that I've missed the mark. After all my years of practice, see. And the Buddha says something so interesting to him. The Buddha says basically, don't worry. You will achieve awakening, complete awakening. But it's going to take you a while. And as Shariputra says, how long? And the Buddha said it's going to take you like 1,000,000,000,000 years. See. And now that would sound discouraging, wouldn't it? But actually, when Shariputra hears it, he's very happy. See, he's very happy, and he says something like, he says, oh, thank you. That is so good to know. Because Shariputra understands something now that he didn't understand before. You know, basically, Shariputra thought that you're unenlightened, you practice, and then you're finally enlightened. And then it's over, and there's nothing more to learn. And, you know, when the Buddha says you will fully awaken, in fact, everybody will fully awaken. Everybody's going to wake up, the Buddha says. But it's going to take a long time. You know, what he really means is that there is no end to the process of waking up. That there's always another dimension to our existence. That there's always something more to learn, and there's always another opportunity to cultivate Buddha nature or awakened mind. And so, you know, what the Buddha really tells him is, everybody is going to wake up. We're all on this road, and we're all practicing, whether we know it or not. Right? We might not know we're practicing, but we're definitely practicing. So, you know, when I was in graduate school, Barb and I moved out of the apartment with the Persians. And we moved into another apartment, and the apartment next to us was occupied by a guy who was a mechanic in the university area. And on weekends, he would work on his own car. His name was, what was his name? I can't remember now, but he would work on his own car, and his car sat right outside of our apartment, you know. And we would hear him working on his car. This guy is a professional mechanic, and we would hear him, you'd hear him cursing, and he'd go, "God damn it," you know. And it was like, we'd listen to this guy, it was like, he's never touching my car, right, you know. He would get so upset, you'd hear him almost like shrieking with frustration. A bolt wouldn't come off or something. Angry. He wasn't an angry person, actually. But when he would try to solve these problems and encounter these obstacles, he would just keep getting terribly, terribly upset. You know, if he keeps fixing cars for another couple of lifetimes, you know, he's going to somebody's going to give him a car, and he's not going to squeak with anger or frustration or cry or weep or tear his hair out. He's going to calmly undo the bolts. He's going to calmly, lovingly, you know, take the belts off and disassemble the engine and look for the problem. You know, it's practice. Fixing a car engine can be practice. You know, you see your fears. You see your limitations. You know, and whether you want to work through them or not, you're going to work through your problems. You know, you can work through them the hard way without Zazen, or you can work through them the easy way with Zazen, but you're going to work through them, you know? And my friend, the mechanic, you know, I can't imagine he's still a mechanic and he's still having those kinds of reactions to problems. He's not screaming and shrieking and throwing his tools across the parking lot, you know? At some point, you grow up a little bit. At some point, you succeed and you develop confidence. At some point, you learn how to tolerate uncertainty, right? So, you know, people are practicing whether they think that what they're doing is practicing or not. You know, I remember going on a hike with my friend Larry Sullivan when we were going to college together. Larry grew up mostly in suburban Washington, D.C. And he really never walked 4 miles in his life. When I met him, I said, "Would you like to go on a hike this summer?" And we took a week off from our jobs, and we went on a hike in the Shenandoah Mountains. And, you know, every step of this activity was torment for my friend Larry. You know, we probably walked about 6 miles, maybe less the first day. I think I planned that we would do 8 miles, which is a pretty substantial hike. And I think after about 3 miles, he was falling apart. You know, and I probably talked him into going on until he was really almost crying, you know. And so we made camp, and sleeping on the ground was something he'd never done. I remember at the end of the hike, he had bought a very, very cheap backpack. It was actually falling apart as we were reaching like the end of our hike. You know, all I can say is that, you know, Larry Sullivan still hikes. You know, like 43 years later, he's still hiking, only now he hikes, you know, in the Alps. He hikes in the Tetons. You know, hiking is practice also. You know, you bring to hiking your ego, you bring to hiking your fears, your attachments. And if you stick with hiking, you gradually work through all of those. You know, if you've ever been on a hard hike, you have to forget yourself. You know, you put one foot after another, your part of your mind is saying, stop, stop, but you don't stop. You go on, and you know, your legs hurt, but you don't listen to your legs. And after a while, the pain in your legs goes away, and then all of a sudden you're on a mountaintop, and you think, well, you know, this that hurt going up. You know, climbing 6,000 feet that's a hard morning, right? But then, you know, you look down and you think, what a fantastic experience. When can I do that again? See, you have a different relationship to yourself at the end of that process. You realize that by not listening to that voice, that small self that says, turn back, stop, why am I doing this? Why am I not in my backyard drinking a beer, see? You don't listen to that voice. You quiet that voice and you go forward. And you go to the top of the mountain and you realize, I'm so glad I didn't listen to my small self. You know, so hiking is practice. Whether we like it or not, we're practicing. See, raising children, I don't have children, but I definitely think raising children has a dimension of practice to it, you know. My sister had an idea that she wanted children. And I think she and her husband had no idea, you know, they had an idea of how nice it would be to pose with, you know, have two kids, go here and there with their kids, go on vacation with their kids, take snapshots of themselves standing, selfies of themselves standing with their kids. But, you know, actually, when you have to actually raise two kids, you know, it's a serious challenge. It's like you have no personal life, you know, for like 16 years until they're really sort of semi-adults. And even then, you don't have a personal life, you know. I remember one of my Dharma friends at the Seattle Zen Center, Joyce Victor, was a therapist. And she told me after she had her first child and she was trying to get back to work, unlike in New Jersey, in Washington State, you gas up your own car. So she said she was so tired, she was going off to work, and she started to drive away from the gas station, and there was like an explosion or a big noise, like a huge pow. And she had forgotten to take the hose out of the gas tank, and it ripped it right out of the machine, right? She was so tired. So, you know, raising children is a practice. You know, it can't be about you anymore. You have to, you know, your small self is saying, you know, screw them, you know, they can feed themselves tonight. You know, I want to read this book. You know, you can't do that, right? You have to make dinner for your kids. You have to, have to make sure their clothes are clean for tomorrow's, you know, school. So whether you like it or not, you're going to practice. You can practice the easy way with Zazen, or you can practice the hard way, but you're going to practice. This is the vision of the Lotus Sutra. So everything is helping us wake up. you know, in order to live this life, we have to get beyond the small self in many different ways. And when we do, we generally feel a great sense of openness and optimism and connection with things. So you know, the vision of the Lotus is that we're all moving towards enlightenment, whether we like it or not. The natural direction of our lives is away from or beyond the small self and towards a larger self. And when we put the small self aside, we connect with the world and with others more deeply and profoundly. We realize our identity with everything around us. So, you know, in the case of hiking, you know, you put the small self says, stop, why do we have to walk to the top? You know, why don't we just walk halfway up? You know, I wish I had a beer. You know, it's too hot. I have a blister. You know, those are all those voices are all there. But you disregard them and you go to the top and you're covered with sweat. And, you know, there are times when you just have to say, wait, I've got to take a minute. I've got to marshal my energy. I'm wiped out. And then you suddenly have more energy. And up you go. You go another 500 feet or another 1,000 feet. And then you get some water and then you go up. But when you get to the top, it's like you've cracked the shell of yourself and you connect with the world more fully. See? And this is practice. Zazen does the same thing. It's the same process, really. My sister has an older boy who has some learning disability issues, you know. And when she had her child, you know, she imagined, I'm sure, that he would be, you know, handsome and socially adept and brilliant, and he is handsome, but he's not socially adept. He has many problems interacting with others, and he might be smart, but he has some sort of Asperger's type aspects to his processing, right? And so he's a real challenge for my sister. But she loves him fiercely. And, you know, that love really, it makes her a much bigger person. You know, it makes her, because if she can love him, she can love so many things and so many people in the world without reservation, without judgment, you know. So the experience of being the parent of this boy for my sister has been, you know, transformative. You know, raising her children has been a practice for her, and it's made her a more open, generous, and compassionate person. And she was even before all of this, you know. So we're practicing whether we know it or not all the time, no matter what we do. We're practicing on the cushion, and we're practicing in life. You know, I had to, when I came here to Rutgers, you know, I had to take over a very large program for first-year students that was in complete disarray, and the man who hired me hoped I would fail. And so if I failed, they would put him back in the job and give him a promotion to full professor. That was the scheme. So, you know, he brought me here thinking I was going to fail. And this was definitely not the academic job I wanted. You know, I wanted to be writing essays on Shakespeare. I didn't want to be writing memos on seating, you know, seat assignments for these students, you know, and classroom shortages and so on. And, you know, as I was going through this process, you know, at times I just really wanted to walk out the door. But, you know, I got to know, you know, the teachers in my program are such wonderful people. And I got to have, it gave me a totally different perspective on university life and on learning and education. And it transformed, you know, my whole thinking about what it means to learn, you know. So it was painful, and there were many steps where I wanted to say, just quit, you know, give up. This is not what I signed up for, et cetera, et cetera. But it was practice, off the cushion practice. So it's the case, first of all, that everybody is practicing all the time, whether they know it or not. And the natural direction of things is towards beyond the small self to a larger self, you know, to connect, really to selfless connection with others, really. That's the natural direction of our lives. We may not get very far, but that's where we're going, according to the Lotus Sutra. And that's part of the message of the sutra, see? But the other part of the message of the sutra is that that process never stops, even for so-called enlightened ones, see? See, and this is what Shariputra finds so liberating. You know, Shariputra has had Daikensho, but he still realizes that he's not where the Buddha, he still has moments where there's things that confuse him or cause him to be envious of others or lustful or selfish. And then he thinks, you know, I must not really have had an awakening experience, you know. But actually, awakening never stops. The early Buddhists were wrong because they thought first you're in samsara and then you're liberated. And it's anuttara samyak sambodhi, right? A complete enlightenment without remainder. But, you know, actually, every stage in waking up is complete enlightenment without remainder. And it never stops being so. So when the Buddha says to Shariputra, you will be a Buddha, but first you have to serve, he says, like a million Buddhas, and you also have to live like 100 billion trillion lifetimes or something. And the reason Shariputra doesn't go, oh crap, that's even worse than I thought. Instead, Shariputra says that's the most wonderful news, because he understands what the Buddha is saying. The Buddha is saying the process of enlightenment never stops. There's always something more to learn. Even if you're the Buddha, there's more to learn. See? It never stops. How could it? See? And so, this is, I think, really, I believe it. You know, it's totally true, you know. I mean, many of my teachers had Daikensho. And, you know, I encountered them as human beings, and they were deeply awake, I would say, but they still had, you know, they still had things to learn, you know. You can have a Daikensho experience, but that doesn't mean you're good at algebra if you weren't good at algebra before. And it doesn't mean you're necessarily particularly good at social relations if that was an obstacle for you. You know, so enlightened people have to learn how to do calculus if they don't know calculus. And they have to learn how to interact in certain social situations if they don't know how to do that. And when they try to do that, they're going to make mistakes. You know, Buddhas make mistakes. Buddhas make mistakes, see? This is so important. That's what's so liberating. You know, if learning never stops, then you know, so it never making mistakes never stopped. And it's a truism, but you can't learn without making mistakes. You know, the great Zen teacher in Japan, Dogen Zenji, you know, said, you know, basically, you know, to practice Zen is to make one mistake after another. One mistake. Now, you know, people read that and they have no, you know, people don't know, they haven't read the Lotus Sutra, so they have no idea what Dogen is talking about. But he means you can't wake up without making mistakes, and there's no end to waking up, so there's no end to making mistakes. But if you're following the path with heart, you know, making mistakes is not a problem, right? You have trust, you trust the process. Trust the process. You know, each of us has to pursue enlightenment in our own way. Each of us has to pursue, and each of us has to manifest and deepen our awakening in our own way. You know, again, the Lotus Sutra is such a beautiful sutra. You know, it says, Buddha mind, enlightened consciousness, is like the rain that comes out of the sky and it covers everything. There's nothing that it doesn't nourish, right? It comes out of the sky. It's like one of these storms we've had where a couple of days ago it was just like white sheets of rain. The Lotus Sutra says enlightenment, Buddha nature, is like that. It comes, it's everywhere. It makes no discriminations. And it says it nourishes everything. It says, you know, it nourishes everything according to its own nature. So, you know, basically, it says, you know, there are mighty oak trees and it nourishes them. And there are great blades of grass that never get higher than a foot and it nourishes them. And they're equal. You know, and there's little shrubs that cling to the side of a mountain, and they're nourished, you know. So, you know, we all have different natures. We all are waking up. We're all on this path of waking up. And basically, you know, the advantage of practicing, so you could say, well, if we're all practicing, what's the advantage of sitting on the cushion? But see, I mean, you know, when you sit on the cushion, I think you realize that Buddha nature is there right now. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and you begin to enter this state, which is very hard to describe, right? It's like we say samadhi sometimes, but it's like sitting in this energy, or sitting in this, I think the best word for it right now is energy. You feel that energy when you sit on the cushion. You feel that openness, that clarity, that brightness, that spaciousness, right? And you know, many people are practicing without being able to access that experience, right? So I think it makes their practice much harder. You know, I know that my mother would have benefited so much from being able to sit down on the cushion and plug into the life energy of Buddha nature. You know, all creatures are nourished by the rain, but not all creatures drink the rain, you know. But it's here all the time. And so the hard way to practice is without zazen. And when you have your problems and you have your frustrations and challenges and you sit down on the cushion, it's like plugging into this life energy, this cool, serene, beautiful, infinite energy. You know, I do it every day. And when I do, I feel like I'm 10 years old. You know, I feel great. Purifying body, mind, and heart. Everybody is purifying body, mind, and heart, but we have like a special way of doing it, which I think it makes everything else a lot easier. It's like tapping directly into that beautiful energy. So, you know, basically, today, if you were sitting and you were annoyed by the beating drum, you could say, you know, I've been practicing for 15 years. Why is that beating drum bothering me? You know, or you can say I want my serenity back. You know, and but actually having a little something to, you know, basically stir up your serenity, it requires you to go deeper into your concentration. It's encountering a barrier. It's like climbing up a mountain in a little way. You have to keep deepening your practice and letting go of your preferences, right? And if you've been practicing for a long time and you say, why is this bothering me? There's always going to be something that bothers you. That's your opportunity to deepen your practice. You know, so I've been practicing for 40 years and there are still things that bother me. And, you know, if I practice for 140 years, there'll still be things that bother me, you know. And that will be wonderful, really precious, because the opportunity for learning never stops. Kasan said, learning by study is called hearing. Learning no more is called nearness. So, you know, when you're studying, when you're studying, you're at a distance from something. So when you're sitting on the cushion and you're hearing the sound of the drum, that's studying the drum. And it might bother you and it might not. When you become one with the sound of the drum, you know, when you hear the sound of the drum and it bothers you, the more it bothers you, the more of an obstacle it becomes, right? The more you try to push it away or make it go away, the more of an obstacle it becomes. The secret is to become one with the sound of the drum. And when you become one with the sound of the drum, the problem disappears. The solution is always becoming one with. Transcending these true two is true passing. True, when you become one with. A monk said, what is true passing? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked again, what is the true teaching of the Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk asked once again, I would not ask you about this very mind as Buddha, but what is no mind, no Buddha? Kasan said, beating the drum. The monk still continued to ask, what? When an enlightened one comes, how do you greet him? Beating the drum. So, practice never stops. Every new thing is an opportunity to deepen your awakened mind. And that's makes life wonderful. Such as verse, dragging a stone, carrying earth, use the spiritual power of a 1,000-ton bow. So Katsu Roshi rolled out 3 wooden balls. How could they surpass Kasan's beating the drum? I will tell you, what is sweet is sweet, what is bitter, bitter.